So eyes on me. There's no gavel for work sessions. That's my new, we'll get rid of one. So these are, you know, supposed to be a little bit more informal, right? So we'll
just,
In order to not make it feel so formal, we'll just start the sessions. Call the roll, I guess, at this point, just to make sure everybody's here. Everybody's here, just for the record, for those taking notes. We have first on our agenda, Martha, communication again.
You know, I don't have anything more. I'm sure this is...
Would you like to repeat?
Would you like me to repeat?
No, I'm just kidding. All right, then we'll just go into our continuation of our work session topic for the 2019 legislative agenda. Randy?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yes, hi.
We have two topics left.
Yeah, and a little bit more that is trying to follow up the conversation from Tuesday. So
Before we launch into that, we wanted to talk quickly, because I don't want to forget, about the question that was raised... that Councilor Gonzalez raised, and I just want to repeat it, about how we handle during the session council priorities and individual councilor priorities or interests. So do you want to talk about how you handled that in the past and how you would move forward in that?
So, first of all, sure, thank you, President Peterson. There are a couple of things I'll say. One, and I think I've spoken to all of you about this over time, but I will refresh your memories on this topic. One thing that's important from my perspective is that we communicate about the contacts that we're having with legislators. So I am not your gatekeeper. I am not your minder. You know, you guys are all, you're all independent, you know, and you're elected, and you have your own relationships. In fact, you often have relationships I don't have, and you are also often in rooms with a lot of elected officials, including members of the legislature. That's all great. It's, you know, I don't mean to get at all in the way of that. It's really important, however, that I be kept in the loop on conversations that are relevant to our work. Yeah. So to the extent that you run into a legislator and you have a conversation about one of the issues that we're working on, even if you just tell me I had this conversation about this issue, that's really helpful to me, because when I see that person and I can mention it, it just makes us all look better. It makes us, makes them know that we talk to each other. And also, if you know in advance that you're going to be seeing somebody, it's helpful for me to know that, because I might have something to ask you to ask them, or something you can give them or tell them. And so we get our work done better if I'm kept in the loop about your relationships with, specifically with legislators and sometimes legislative staff. So that's one thing. I think the other question is, what happens when you want to take an independent position as an elected official? You have that prerogative. I am not the person to stand in your way. I just ask you to, A, know if you are carrying forward a position that is not a Metro Council position, and B, to express that clearly if that's the case. So it's happened, certainly not that often, but occasionally it's happened that there's been difference of opinion on the council, and different councillors have wanted to make their voices heard. And that's your right, as I said, your prerogative as elected officials. If there's a council position, then, and you're expressing that position, great. If you're expressing a different position from the council position, I just ask that you make it clear that you're speaking for yourself and not for the council. Other than that, I don't think I have any admonitions for you. I think that's common sense, but it's helpful to say it out loud.
Yep.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yep.
Are there further questions about that?
Good.
Great. So I sent you some email late last night, and the relevant portions of it are reproduced in front of your paper, and I think they're maybe also on your screens. But what I wanted to do was to actually follow up on the conversation we had Tuesday and show you that I've already made the changes that you requested, I think, before we get back into the big issues we have remaining to discuss. So I'm going to quickly walk you through this. Hopefully it won't take very long. First of all, the legislative priorities sheet that you have on paper, I've made three changes. One is a small one at the bottom of the first page. I had an exchange with Elliot Rose, our Living Technologies guy, who has become aware that in addition to the transportation network companies and the automated vehicles, there is the whole dockless world out there with scooters, etc., who may be also seeking some sort of preemptive type of legislation. So I've just added a catch-all phrase about other technology-driven transportation innovations in this item below, to say that, you know, the same interests that we described to you the other day about data sharing and about anti-preemption basically would apply in those circumstances. So I've added that. On the back, I've added an item on plastic bags, and we could have a discussion, if you like, about how to phrase this. I put a little phrase in brackets there. Okay, so I'll just read it. Support a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags that A, does not preempt local authority, and B, doesn't impose a direct cost on consumers. So I would probably recommend that we delete that last phrase. It's in brackets. Because I think, you know, there is a controversial element of this conversation around whether if there's a plastic bag ban, whether the retailers can charge for paper bags. Portland does not allow that. Hillsboro does, and so they've each got one of these ordinances already in place. They take different approaches. There is an argument against the fee that is an equity-based argument, and it's. You know, that's a fair argument. We might want to even say something more generic, or we can just be silent on that for now and see what kind of proposals come forward. I do think we want to make sure that we're protecting the communities that have already made this decision. And so focusing on not preempting would be something that I would probably, you know, recommend that you include in this statement here. And certainly we can respond to the actual proposals as they come forward. And by the way, the bills did appear online today, but I've only gotten through the first 250 out of 1,500, you know, and I haven't actually read them yet. I've just kind of, you know, rejected a bunch of them.
Can we just add something about equity?
We could instead of saying imposing a direct cost on consumers, and that you know, something along the lines of, you know, addresses the, well, I don't know, I had it in my mind earlier, but I can come up with some phraseology there if you like.
Yeah, let's just do that generically, if everybody's okay. Yeah. Councilor Craddock?
Well, I just wanted to, when Councilor Dirksen and I met with Senator Haas about the experience he had, and he says he's no way he's going to get back into this. We have to care our own water. He's not going to help us. and he said the reason why it was so challenging was the grocery industry really got engaged and did not want to have to. They wanted the ability to charge for paper bags. And I appreciate Randy's suggestion here because... Councilor Dirksen and I were just talking this morning. There's a lot of bags that you can take to the store.
Yeah.
You don't have to use paper bags. So I'm open to charging or not charging, and I don't think that's our effort. I just want to get the ban passed.
Councilor Dirksen and Councilor Chase.
Well, I would suggest that if such a ban was passed with a charge for bags, that we could actually, as Metro, start a program. We would provide anyone who wants with reusable cloth bags or whatever for their grocery shopping. And I would be happy to take on that burden if it meant we could.
You're going
to
sew them?
No, we do it already. I have three bags at home that say Metro. I might take them to New Seasons.
Yeah.
I get a nickel bag. I'm not getting a paper bag.
Also, Chase?
Well, I support taking that clause out and adding something around equity, but I just don't want to start out in a position that is very confined to the cost equation where, you know, a 5 cents per bag probably doesn't even cover near the cost of the bag. So I just wouldn't want to sort of kill our proposal right out of the gate by having these conditions on it. And I just think addressing equity is the issue.
Yeah.
I want to reinforce what Councillor Dirksen said. As a part of the regional waste plan, there were a lot of recommendations around Metro potentially taking a stance on or investing in a bag program for households. So I want to support that idea. I will also be there to carry that needle.
So I'm While you were talking, I wrote some language. How about this? I was also
listening.
It's only seven words or so. So, support a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags that does not preempt local authority or create an undue burden on low-income consumers.
Yeah.
Is that satisfactory?
Is it?
Okay. So, last on this sheet, I'm opening a new can of worms, and I will say this is irregular on my part. I generally try to get you your issue papers well in advance. I will say that, you know, I failed to include this issue that we've actually worked on before, and I feel like I'm hoping it's not controversial among you. And I sent out last night, hopefully you saw this letter, that Council President Hughes and the director of the zoo, Don Moore, submitted last session, and we submitted a similar letter the previous session. There's been an effort, and I may lean on Marcia Sinclair for a little help if I flail here, but there's been an effort for the last couple of years to create what is called the Oregon Recreation and Conservation Fund. Conservation and Recreation Fund, excuse me. Out of ODF&W, and the primary goal is there's some federal legislation that has been, you know, moving along, has not yet passed, which would provide funding to states if they come up with a significant match, but it would provide more funding than the match money. I think it's a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio. Representative Helm has been leading the way on this in Salem. And so we have just submitted letters of support for this effort in the past to create this fund, put some money in it so it's there, and the purpose of it is to support conservation work for non-game wildlife conservation and habitat restoration work, as well as some education as work. And so it's possible that this could even benefit Metro. I think the zoo is supporting it not for that reason, but because it furthers their mission of creating a better future for wildlife. But it could possibly benefit Metro in terms of providing funding for restoration in our natural areas or some zoo education programs. That's a sort of a secondary issue, in at least my recommendation to you. I would just urge that this be added to the list. We would not play any kind of a lead role on this, but the zoo has been putting some energy into this, and some of the zoo staff who wear another hat with the Oregon Wildlife Society have also been working on it with those hats on. And so I would suggest adding it to the list here, mainly just so that legislators see it when I hand this sheet of paper out, and it gets a little bit of a lift that way. So.
Very good. Discussion?
Not this specifically, but something related to the zoo.
Oh, question.
Go ahead. I saw what I don't see on here that we've had in the past is the effort to get legislation to support non-lead ammunition. And I don't see that referenced here. Is that just an oversight?
No, and correct me if I'm wrong, Marcia, but I think the reason is that the zoo is not supporting a legislative or regulatory approach to non-lead ammunition. They're supporting an educational approach. That's right. And you know, as you know, they have a staff member who spends a lot of time on outreach to hunters and gun shops and the hunting community in general, and is making headway that way and building relationships. And so I think the strategic decision at the zoo has been not to take a regulatory or statutory approach, but to take an educational and collaborative approach instead. That's why it's not on here.
Okay. Wasn't an
oversight. Am I right?
Absolutely right.
Okay, good.
Conscious.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Let me shut this thing off. Lobbyist calling me. So, that's this sheet of paper. Thank you very much. Now, for the principles, and then we'll get to the two issues that we picked over. So I've tried to respond to your comments the other day, and I'll quickly run you through this on the version that you have today. On item one, I deleted the word planning that Councilor Lewis suggested. Item four is affordable housing, which has been dragged out of that land use section and given its own section and elaborated somewhat. Deleted the 50% thing because, you know, statistics don't really rise to the level of principles. I think the idea was more important than the number, but that's been our, I think, sort of definition of cost burden. So, and so hopefully this captures most of what we care about at a high level, and we'll get into the specifics of what's being proposed for this session in a moment. And on page 2, again, at Councilor Gonzalez's suggestion, I've extracted the first concept that was in the producer responsibility section and made it its own principle, which, having spoken to Paul Sliman and Scott Flagg about how we ought to articulate this, that they argued that we should focus on the life cycle approach as the high-level principle. It does, for instance, encompass the plastic bag idea, which is not encompassed in the product stewardship idea. You'll see a little footnote at the end. That's a reference to the regional waste plan. I took a look at that to make sure that I wasn't saying anything that was inconsistent or, you know, off base. I've also sort of cleaned up and made a little bit more succinct and readable the product stewardship language, as well as adding the term to the heading, producer responsibility, which is sort of the alternate term for what we're talking about, and is more explicit about the fact that you're asking the people that make the stuff to step up. So I'm hopeful that this language... Oh, and one thing I skipped over, by the way, up above in number 11, this is just a small clarification. I added to the name of that principle, integration of land use and transportation. It's in the land use section, so it was kind of, you know, you've got to relate it back to what that section's about. So I just made these few changes that I hope respond to the concerns you raised, or the I wouldn't say concerns, the questions you raised the other day.
Thank you. Any comments on those?
Okay. Great. So let's go to the two issues we have not yet discussed. I think I'll start with housing. Okay? First of all, as some of you know, but others of you don't, we have long been members of the Oregon Housing Alliance. We joined pretty much, I think, the first year I arrived at Metro, which is back, well, it was in the 21st century, but not too deep into it. It was right when the Housing Alliance, you know, came into existence, and we were some of, you know, among the earliest members, and have been consistently members. And it's a great place to sit down and talk to people who really understand housing. It's also a place where everyone around the table understands housing more than I do, but luckily we have other staff now that can help me out. Our angle into sort of our piece of the pie that is more directly related to Metro, it was fairly narrow for many years, but now our housing work has grown dramatically in the last 4 or 5 years, something like that, and obviously even more dramatically in the last couple of months. And it's really important for us to be around this table, and it's really helpful to us. The Housing Alliance puts forward a pretty comprehensive legislative agenda that includes a lot of material that we don't really engage with. A lot of it is related to funding and specific funding programs and specific funding streams and tax credits and particular programs at Oregon Housing Community Services Department. But I'm going to highlight a few that I think are going to be, first of all, you will care about, and that are coming and that are going to be controversial. Okay, so there are two, I think, that are at the top of that list, a third that's pretty near the top of that list. So I'll just mention those three first. Just cause evictions, missing middle housing, zoning essentially for missing middle housing, and rent stabilization. And I'm going to take them in no particular order. I'm just going to take them. Okay. And let me preface this whole conversation about housing by saying I don't expect a conclusive answer from you about our positioning on these concepts today. They are going to be moving targets. The bills are just coming out. I do have the missing middle concept because it's House Bill 2001. It's the very first bill on the you know, when I opened everything up, and so I've got that one. But A, I don't have a lot of the other ones, and B, this one's probably going to change anyway. So what I'm trying to do today is familiarize you with what's forthcoming get a general sense of your questions, concerns, and direction. But I will be in touch with you as these conversations advance on these particular bills. Okay, so just to set the stage and set the expectations reasonably, because I don't think we can. It's a lot of material here. So, just cause evictions. There was a bill in 2017, and what's being proposed this year is modeled significantly upon that, and it would allow no cause evictions in the first year of a tenancy, but then after that would prohibit no cause. What did I say? It would allow no cause evictions in the first year. After that, it would require cause. In other words, failure to pay the rent, destruction of property, whatever it might be, or will still continue to allow no-cause evictions for a certain specified list of reasons, which include things like you or your family, the landlord or the family member moving into the unit, major remodels or demolition, conversion of the dwelling unit to a use other than residential use, etc. So there's a list. This is the bill from 2 years ago, but apparently this list is going to be modeled on this bill. So that's concept one. So it would allow no-cause evictions for the first year and then prohibit them after that, except under specified circumstances. Concept two. Unless you want to discuss them as we go. Keep going. Concept two would be, let's say, the rent stabilization. Let's do that next. In the past, often known as rent control, the advocates are very diligently trying to change that terminology to rent stabilization. This, I will say, has been controversial among the staff here at Metro. Not everyone comes at it from the same direction. The proposal is going to be that rent stabilization requirements. Well, first of all, in the past, there's been a proposal to. It's prohibited at the statewide level, and no local government can control rents. In the past, there have been a proposal to lift that preemption and to allow local governments to engage in some form of control of rents. The proposal that's forthcoming this year is not that. The proposal that's forthcoming is a statewide policy, not an allowance for local governments to do what they want. The proposal is to allow to have no rent stabilization policy at all for the first 15 years after a certificate of occupancy.
So you're talking about with new construction.
New construction would not be subject to this policy for the first 15 years. Anything that already exists and that is less than 15 years old would not be subject to it until 15 years after it had received its certificate of occupancy. And anything older than that would be subject to it. And the restriction is one rent increase a year, no more than 7% plus CPI, which would, you know, roughly another 2%. So about a 9% cap on annual rent increases. That's, you know, it would vary, of course, but 7% plus CPI. It would not apply. You'd have a clean slate upon a turnover, you know, a vacancy in the apartment, unless there had been a no cause eviction in the first year of that tenancy. And then I think I just got the answer before I came in here, but I think the 7% would apply in that case. So that's what's being proposed. As you know, we have we've had a rental sort of a housing crisis in Oregon for quite some time. It's softening now, according to statistics, but that doesn't apply to every unit out there. Obviously, it applies to the median, and so some people are still experiencing serious problems with affordability. Concerns that have been raised historically and potentially in this context around these kinds of proposals are that they discourage the production of housing. That's what the 15-year lag, or whatever you want to call it, is intended to address. That they discourage tenant or landlords, excuse me, from keeping up their apartments if they or their units if they can't expect to be able to raise the rents to cover the costs. And there are other concerns that have been raised over time. The advocates, I believe, are really trying to address those concerns, and they're trying to reach out to landlord groups and see what kind of support they can get. I'm probably missing a few arguments on both sides of this discussion, but I wanted to get out what's being proposed. So I'll probably think of more to tell you about that. The third concept that is very controversial, and especially among some of our local government partners, is the missing middle concept. The idea there is it's the one that has also been described in the media. You may have seen material about this. It's described in the media as eliminating single family zoning. So what it calls for,
accurately referred to as.
So here's what it is. It would allow, if it would apply to a city with a population greater than 10,000 and a county with a population greater than 15,000. So obviously it would apply throughout the metro area. It would require that all of local governments, you know, that fit that definition, allow in all zones that, sorry, I believe it's in every single family zone or in any zone that allows housing, would allow duplexes, triplexes, quads, and cottage clusters. Cottage clusters has a definition here, which is no fewer than 4 detached housing units per acre with a footprint of less than 900 square feet each that include a common courtyard. So they came up with a definition. And then it would require local governments to amend their code by the end of next year, amend their comprehensive plan, to comply with this requirement. We're hearing some objections from some of our local government partners, and they fall into sort of two categories. And I can editorialize a little bit if you want about the two categories. You can tell me whether you like that or not. Category one is policy. Is this a good idea, and does it constitute some sort of a preemption of local government authority to do zoning? Okay. Category two is workability. What is this going to entail in terms of redoing your comprehensive plan? And then if you redo your comprehensive plan, do you then have to redo all of your other plans, your capital improvement plan, your transportation system plan, et cetera, to comply with your new comp plan? What's it going to mean in terms of infrastructure provision? If suddenly a single family neighborhood can accommodate 4 times as many units, do you know what does it mean for pipes and pavement and parking and everything else, right? So there are, again, there's the policy question, which includes is it a good idea, and also includes a question around local government authority, and then there's the workability question. Now for the editorial comment, just give you a heads up that is coming. Part of the conversation we have at the staff level is, you know, is this preemption? Because that's what some of our local government partners are saying.
No, it's a mandate.
And so my argument is, no, it's not preemption. We, as we discussed on Tuesday, you have a policy that directs me how to act, which is that the state should set policy and process, but should not zone individual pieces of property. And this is not zoning of individual pieces of property. This is overarching policy. You know, the state can say you may not have racial covenants. That's a policy. The state can say you must allow ADUs, which they did just last session. And that's a policy. And it's not that much different there. So I would argue that it's firmly within in the box of the things that we believe the state should have the authority to do, at least according to the policy you've given me in the past. On the workability side, I do have concerns, and I'm not sure if some of our local government partners are a little bit, hair on fire about this, but I will defer to them to make their case. But I do believe that it's important that we make sure that they are not given a task and they can't actually execute financially and time-wise. And there is a provision in this legislation for LCDC to give some grants. At the staff level, we had conversations about, at some point we were thinking it may apply to smaller cities, which I think it will. Well, it's unclear actually if it applies to the small cities that are not governed by the counties within the UGB. At any rate, we have grant programs that might be able to help with this kind of rezoning that the staff has floated, again, internally in conversations about potentially using to help.
Code amendments to authorize this kind of development.
Right, right. So I think I've said what I need to say about this right now to just give you the familiarity with the concept. It's going to be highly controversial. It's also House Bill 2001, sponsored by Speaker Kotek. It's clearly a very, very high priority for one of the two chamber leaders. You don't get House Bill 2001 unless you really care about it, right? So, and by the way, House bills start with 2001. There is no House Bill 1. The Senate gets
well,
one. This is the first bill of the House. So, anyway, those are the three, I think, that are the most, well, that are the highest profile for the session. I'll mention two more things, and then, very quickly, and then I'll love to, have a conversation. One is that with the passage of the Metro Bond measure, which is aimed significantly toward lower income people, in the deeper affordability end of the spectrum, we know that we're going to need, in addition to capital funding, we're going to need operational funding for permanent supportive services in some of these areas or units or developments. I'm going to be watching the legislature for anything that might help on that front, but I believe the Housing Alliance's agenda is mostly focused on investments in capital investments in. I'm getting myself confused. They're both okay. So, I'll be watching for any kind of legislation that will help with implementing our bond measure in that realm. Okay, and then the last thing is there's going to be a proposal to limit the mortgage interest deduction. My understanding of the starting position is that it's going to be based not on the value of the mortgage, but on the income of the mortgage holder. That it will, first of all, it will disallow mortgage interest deduction for second homes. And then for primary homes, it will start to phase out the deduction at an income level of $200,000 and have it totally phased out by $250,000. And I believe that is a joint income level. It's not $200 or $400 for a couple. I think it's $200 for a couple or for anybody. But I haven't seen the actual legislation. So that's going to be obviously a Donnybrook. But I put it out there for discussion. So we got a handful of interesting and controversial housing measures that are forthcoming, and I will be looking for policy direction from you.
Councilor Craddock, Dirk Sundin, the list.
Thank you. So that regarding the missing middle, your statement is the proposal would require local government to change your zoning code to allow da da da. So when you use the word definition, change zoning code, does that mean, so right now, let's say you have single family residential zone, does that mean every lot in that zone would allow missing middle?
I found the language. Let me just read you this sentence. Each city with a population greater than 10,000 and each county with a population greater than 15,000 shall allow within its urban growth boundary, which... Of course, counties don't have urban growth boundaries. We'll fix that. Within its urban growth boundary, in areas zoned for detached single-family dwellings, the development of at least one middle housing type on each lot, subject to reasonable local regulations related to siting and design. So each lot in those zones.
But only one type.
You can choose. You can do a duplex, a triplex, a quad, or a cottage cluster, I guess.
But if you're the only one.
Yeah.
And this language is
I was going to say more draconian, but it's harsher than what the residential infill program that Portland was looking at, which was
more comprehensive.
Which is more comprehensive, more analytical about where you could actually do this and how much. So this takes it to the entire zone. I'm assuming that there's some negotiations that will happen.
Oh, yes. And by the way, to finish the answer also to Councilor Craddock, the next line says, notwithstanding blah, 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 each local government subject to Section 2, which was what I just read you, of this 2019 Act, shall update its comprehensive plan and land use regulations to implement Section 2 of this 2019 Act. And it said that's by December 31st of next year, 2020. So that's what it says.
I can see that. It's pretty challenging.
Another question?
Yes, I did. I have... do you want me to stay on the same subject, or can I switch to a different... So the question that I don't understand is the number 7, provide funding for ongoing operations and supporting services to serve people with low income and higher needs. Tell me more about that. I'm not sure if I know what that really means. What's the challenge that we're seeing that we need this?
Can you help me, Jess? Yeah. This is where I need my certified smart people here.
Councilor Craddock, the question... I think is what are the kinds of supportive and operating subsidies needed to make sure our bond is successful? The bond generally set a goal of 41% or 1,600 of the total units produced, 3,900, to be affordable at and below 30% median family income. And the cost of constructing a building is always the same no matter what rents you're going to charge for who lives in the building, but the cost of maintaining and operating that building permanently to maintain those affordable rents depends on how much rent you're collecting from the unit. Mm-hmm. So the deeper the affordability, the lower the rents, and the greater the need for operating costs over a longer period of time. Because our bond is only capital financing, we can't schedule in permanent operating costs. The rents from higher incomes can help to pay for the rents to cover the difference for lower incomes. But overall, there are places where there might be a gap, particularly in Multnomah County, where they had already scheduled out commitments for project-based vouchers, and so we were able to achieve a commitment from both Clackamas and Washington counties for 200 project-based vouchers to be committed in partnership with this regional bond. Basically, they brought that provides a significant amount of operating subsidy to achieve that deep affordability rent permanently for Washington, Clackamas counties, but we knew Multnomah County didn't have that same commitment in place. So working with the state to identify opportunities to secure those kinds of vouchers or other revenue tools that are being considered for both operating costs, that's the buying down the rent or making sure the rent stay permanently and deeply affordable, and then also the supportive services to help some of the households who generally have those lower incomes and might also need additional case management, health care, mental health care supports to be successful in housing.
So it's a fund that would need to be ongoing, it's not one-time money.
That's said very succinctly.
Thank you.
And what I'm not clear about is how that
works.
How that is being advanced in the legislature, and if it's being advanced in a way that would help us implement the bond measure. Because I know I've just identified in the Housing Alliance agenda or endorsements, they're endorsing, the governor's budget proposes $50 million in general obligation bonds to help develop new supportive housing, but that doesn't help us if we're developing supportive housing, right? And then there'd be vouchers to support those units.
Right.
So we have to figure out if there's a way that the state is going to do anything that could help, or if we can advance something that the state would help operationally once we've got units built.
May I? So I see the possibility that it occurs state now is going to, the legislature is going to try to be part of this, and they want to generate opportunities to build more affordable housing, that we're going to end up competing for these vouchers, which, I mean, that's
that will probably be the limiting factor, is having enough vouchers available for all the different programs. And I can see us competing against each other. Is that, so you agree with that?
Generally there is not enough supply of vouchers for the need across the state. I think rather than seeing it as a competitive force or kind of relationship, seeing it as an opportunity to utilize those vouchers, and actually the Housing Alliance agenda does identify a concept where the OHCS, Oregon Housing Community Services, is working with OHA, Oregon Health Authority, to secure 200 vouchers from Medicaid funding to serve people with mental health needs in the housing that would be created by the $50 million general obligation proposal. And those dollars might mix with our bond dollars, and we could partner with OHA to help create a place for those vouchers to be placed and those households to be served. So I kind of frame it more as an opportunity for partnership.
But going forward, this is one of the issues that needs to be stabilized as well, mm-hmm. not just the capital construction.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Big time, yeah.
Councilor Dirksen?
Thank you. I was prepared to be opposed to item 2 and 3, the tenant protections against no-cause evictions and stronger protections against rent increases. As a former landlord myself, I thought about what would that impact be on me as someone who's trying to own and operate a housing. And most of the stuff that I did own, I would call affordable housing. But I have to say that the language that I've heard suggested, that Randy has suggested in both of those, actually take away much of the concerns that I would have as a landlord, because it does give significant amount of flexibility on how you could deal with that. There will be, I think, if these move forward, there will be some negative unintended consequences. The first one, with no-cause evictions, if you eliminate no-cause evictions, the immediate impact of that will be there will be a lot more for-cause evictions. Because there are a lot of times a landlord will evict a tenant specifically for no cause, but in fact there really was a cause. But by saying there's no cause, it does not limit their ability to find a rental again. If they in fact have a for-cause eviction on their record, it will make it much more difficult for them to rent in the future.
Interesting.
So it's a challenge. It will be a challenge.
Impact on tenants.
Yes, it'll be an impact. The second one on rent increases, in my case, I had longer-term resident tenants that I would not raise their rent for years at a time, knowing that when the time came when my costs rose, that I would be able to raise the rent significantly as much as I needed to in order to make up the difference. If I'm limited on how much I can do that, it will lead many landlords to automatically raise the rent every year to the amount they're allowed to do so. And so it could actually have, at least during the shorter term, a negative impact on limited income renters. In both of these cases, I had confessed that I have no idea how to address that. And I'm not opposed to the idea of both of these actions, legislative actions, but I would be concerned and hopeful that those who craft these would consider language that would help mitigate those negative impacts. With regard to the issue around missing middle housing, I think much of the opposition to it is based on a misunderstanding of what it means. It does not ban single-family housing. I think the operative word here is allow. It allows these multiplexes to be built. It does not require them to be built. And it really increases the flexibility and rights that that property owners have on how they can use their land. And in many cases, particularly around, I understand that Randy's comments about workability had to do with the ability of the jurisdiction to follow the dictates of it. But as far as the actual workability is how this would work in the neighborhood and in the city, the private sector will determine what that balance is, and they will find out how to make that work. I find it somewhat ironic that the proposed language of the bill It's only for cities over 10,000 people. I spent the vast majority of my childhood living in towns that were smaller than that. And duplexes and triplexes are ubiquitous in those towns. And so the idea that smaller municipalities wouldn't have any use for multiplexes, I don't understand where that concept comes from. It's very useful in small towns where oftentimes average incomes are lower than in larger cities, why they would not want or need to have that kind of housing there as well. But again, that's in many cases the devil's in the details, and I'm sure hopefully there will be members of the legislature who will point out these issues as well that come from rural areas saying, like, why wouldn't the town of Fossil need to have this as well? On number 8, the limit to the mortgage interest deduction, I'm not opposed to the idea of a limiter, but again, the devil there is in the details. I think we'll need to watch very carefully as we watch that language be crafted, if it is, and what kind of limitation it is and how it's enacted. If, as Randy has suggested, the proposed language stipulates a specific income at which point this would take effect, I'd be very concerned about that. Hopefully the state writes laws that become open-ended. Throwing out, just pulling from the air, let's say $200,000. Well, 15 years from now, $200,000 might be an average person's salary. We don't want laws that would disincentivize or restrict average Oregonians from being able to purchase a home and being able to be incentivized to do so by being able to deduct that mortgage. And so if the language were changed to, say, a percentage of the income variables, I don't know how you would describe it. Again, I'm not the person to write the language. But it's got to be some sort of a sliding scale and taking into account the fact that people's incomes and average incomes are going to vary over time, and that needs to be addressed as part of this. So I would be, in each of the cases of all of these, while I'm generally supportive of the general concept, whether or not in the end I think this council should be supportive is going to be very dependent on what the actual specific language is that goes forward.
I just quickly mentioned, I've tried to find out details of these proposals so that I can present them to you, and one that I forgot to ask about whether there's some kind of an inflation element to that, but I'll find out about that.
I guess my background, having sat at the Housing Alliance table representing the local jurisdiction, I really do think that there's so much value to be had at sitting at that table, and I'm glad we're a member. I am broadly supportive of all of the points discussed. It hurts a little bit to hear that we're not going to be fighting to lift the preemption as a believer in local control and performance at the most local level, but I do think this is a good tactic. Randy, a question for you. With the 7%, is there still consideration of a policy that you could apply for, like, a one-time exception based on, like, a major renovation or rehab, or is that out the window now that we're just...
I think the renovation or rehab is in there, isn't it?
The renovation or rehab is there in the Just Cause proposal, yeah. But I don't know actually on the,
because I think if there is the opportunity to have a new roof and a new hot water and a this and a that all at once, I think that gets Councillor Dirksen to what you were saying. If you've only had modest increases for the past few years and now you're facing down this big deal, maybe that one time only 15%, and then you go back to your 2 or 3 a year. I think that is maybe where you're coming from, and a policy that I had heard discussed in the past.
Good point.
Do you know if that issue has been addressed?
Not specifically to major renovations, but reset at time of tenancy turnover. So the landlord can set the rent at any point when a tenant comes out.
New tenant.
Unless there was a no-cause eviction in the first year.
Under this bill.
I had a conversation with Allison today.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess the one piece that's not here, and that is not our role, but based on where we come from, a vision of leading with equity, fair housing is always an afterthought, and I'd like us to make sure that fair housing is considered in every one of these policies, particularly around implications for what eviction is and what it looks like, and screening criteria.
second of all.
Randy, on point one, provide funding and incentives to build and preserve affordable housing. Is that a tax and or profit incentive for market housing to be sold as to like an affordable housing developer or ownership or anything like that?
To be clear, this sheet was written a couple of months ago, and it's dated November. The Housing Alliance's agenda has come together since then, and many of the funding elements of their agenda are sort of not directly applicable to Metro's work. As I think I said earlier, we don't really get into the guts of like what they're doing with the earned income tax credit or the, you know, all these other things that are part of their agenda. However, one thing that is mentioned here, the capital gains tax exemption, which actually then became a capital gains tax credit, that would have been very helpful to Metro in implementing the housing bond, in the sense that it would have made it easier maybe to acquire existing buildings.
Yeah.
That apparently is not moving forward right now because there isn't a champion for it. And so that's my understanding from the Housing Alliance meeting that happened earlier this week. So we'll be watching for any of the funding ideas that would have applicability to making it easier to implement our bond measure. But in the past, we've weighed in sort of as one of the larger scrum on things like the document recording fee increase. But many of the funding proposals are for specific programs at the state agency that are not as directly something that Metro has weighed in on. So. Anything else to say about that? No. Okay.
That was more or less the. Maybe I need to learn a little more about how capital gains would work in that system. But just a general concept.
Right.
My thoughts are if for example there was a private landowner, developer, building owner, etc. that would want to take advantage of a program like this to transfer ownership into permanent affordability, just to make sure that...
That's where the capital gains tax credit would be helpful. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly that situation.
Excellent. My only flag...
That's not moving forward
right now. For future considerations would be to ensure that it's not like an incredibly dilapidated state where it's just being transferred and we're absorbing all those costs,
right.
Et cetera. Generally supportive of everything else. I would like to see language as well.
Sure.
I do want a voice on the missing middle housing or the Bill 2001. In my opinion, I think it's congruent with our land use strategy, and I think that that's kind of the policies that we need to be pursuing in the housing crisis for the future. So,
thanks. And at the staff level, we had a conversation early on, and we suggested back to the speaker's office. Why only cities above 10,000?
Mm-hmm.
But as Councilor Dirksen also suggested, we said, well, just make it apply within the Metro UGB as well.
Yeah.
We do have hundreds of thousands of people living outside of cities inside Metro UGB.
That was going to be my next question.
I think the language that
counties covers that.
That's what it says.
The language that adds counties, that does address those unincorporated areas.
Right.
And I'll explore.
This is not written right.
It's not written right, but it's moving in the direction of being more inclusive of the areas within our UGB. And then the question remains, what about the smaller cities? Are they included or excluded based on this language? I'm not clear on that. So
why would they be excluded? What's the rationale?
Yeah. Before we go to Councilor Craddock, you answered my question, but it sounds like on the single family we're generally supportive of the concept, but it sounds like there needs to be some sideboards created to it. Is it really all single family, or is it? There's going to be some issues raised by our municipalities that I think are valid, and we should listen and figure out what those are and help support that.
So the call I received earlier was from Erin Doyle from the League of Cities, who I contacted about this. So I'll find out what she has to say later.
On the mortgage interest deduction, income deduction, does that apply to ADUs, or are we just going? Did we just kill the very thing that we said we wanted?
Good question.
That's a second house.
Good question.
That's a
good question.
You get
second
mortgage on those?
You got to finance for some of them.
Ours will be one in the end.
Well, if it's a rental, unit, it wouldn't. So actually, now that I've taken 2 seconds to think about it, this is mainly aimed at vacation homes. A rental unit is you don't usually take the mortgage interest deduction directly. You Well, I guess an ADU is different because it's on the same lot.
It just depends on what it's being used for. So
which is a good question.
If it's being rented versus if you're living with a family.
The mother-in-law is actually living in it.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So why don't we take the question?
It sounds like the language has taken that into consideration.
Yeah, that was my only question.
That's right. Well, back up to number three, authorize strong protections against rent increases. And I just want to think about what's happened in the east part of the region where so much of the affordable housing is for-profit affordable housing, where it's not owned by nonprofits, it's owned by private owners or people that are, what do you call people that live far away when they're the...
Resident or absentee landlords.
Yeah.
I was trying to think. So how do we
do we still say naturally occurring affordable housing, or do we not say that anymore?
So how do we not promote that? I question that's a real problem where the housing that is affordable that's owned by somebody and the landlord lives in some other country or state and they could care less about what's happening with that property. How do we protect that from happening?
Well, I think that's maybe primarily what this legislation is aimed at more than... Yeah,
I think you have to do that through housing codes. The rent control is not the solution to that problem. And let me also say, if it's 7% plus CPI, we're still talking about 9, 10, 11% rent increases. This is not rent.
That's what took away a lot of my opposition, was right there.
It's not really yet. I agree. So... can we close out?
I have not commented.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm only induced to do so, Madam President, because of your admonition that we might want to see some sideboards on the
single family zone.
Yeah. In my neighborhood, most of my neighbors have sideboards that I think are preposterous. I'm guided by the deliberations of the City of Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission, which said, staff, nice proposal, except it's not ambitious enough. You have too many sideboards. You apply this missing middle strategy too conservatively, and we're going to exempt slopes like this. We're going to exempt certain areas for certain good reasons, but for goodness sake, why not? And I'd like to see that be the starting point and let thousands of people come forward with a proposal to add sideboards, will happen in any event.
I'm not proposing sideboards. I'm saying listen to what comes forward, and then we can react to those sideboards.
Sure.
Okay. Good. Wait.
So,
I'm sorry.
I really like the agenda. I thought, Craig, some of your points were really excellent, and I vote for sending Craig down to talk about this. The legislature has questions about it because I thought you were spot on that. This is our chance in the climate that we're in to actually eliminate a practice that's only been in place for 60 or 70 years. For generations, missing middle was very easy and was the standard for what was done in communities. And so this is our chance to get rid of exclusionary zoning. And I know we don't like to frame it that way, but it's a unique opportunity. I'm very excited about that opportunity, and I'm glad to see this on the agenda. I think that the cities need to negotiate their conditions and terms and concerns directly with the legislature and in that process, and through the League of Cities. But certainly would be interested in hearing what comes out of that as it goes. The rent stabilization, I think, is excellent, and I am one that agrees with, virtually all economists that rent control is not productive in addressing housing supply. This is not rent control. This is not the rent control of years of past, or San Francisco, or places where we've seen it executed well. This is a very reasonable way of putting some moderation on rent increases. I mean, it seems extreme to me to raise rents more than 10% a year, and so that's all it's really doing is taking some of the extremities out. I guess I'm not going to repeat things that I thought were excellently well said. my one comment is about our Housing Alliance and the commitment to the Housing Alliance. I think we've grown very dependent on Housing Alliance in terms of fleshing out a lot of these issues that are closer and closer to our core work now. Are we in a appropriate level of support of the Housing Alliance in terms of our, you know, staff commitment to supporting their agenda and helping them in that process, and our financial membership contribution? Is it how has that changed over time, and are we stepping up in that support as we're asking for more from them and depending on them more?
I don't remember the exact cost of membership, but it is deep into the four figures. I don't know, $4,000 to $5,000 about a year, which is significant. It's based on our size to some extent, and Jess and I participate pretty actively on especially the land use and development work group of the Housing Alliance. I've been participating to some extent a little bit in their in the home ownership work group lately, because they've been talking about another concept that's listed on here, the condo concept, which is, I will say, probably not moving forward right now. When we started pulling the strings on that one, we can talk about it if you want, but when we started digging into that, it got very complicated very fast, and there's no one stepping up to really take the lead on it right now. But so we're pretty active at the staff level, as well as you recall, Measure 102, Metro played a major role in making sure that was drafted correctly. Obviously, we had a very strong interest in getting that right with the bond measure looming in front of us at that time. So I played a big role. Allison in OMA at that time played a big role in both drafting and making sure that it was legally correct, as well as thinking through the politics of that. So we're pretty active within the organization. Obviously, I'm not sure if I heard you right at the beginning, we also depend on that organization to develop a lot of policies. You know, they work on housing full time, and I certainly don't. They're good partners that we spend a lot of time with, so I'm not sure if that answers your question.
That's good to hear, and if there was some sort of check back with them about are we landing, or some reconciliation in terms of are we landing in the right place in terms of our financial commitment to making sure that work continues in the excellent manner that it has been continuing, I think that would be, you know, something I would support looking at. I'm not going to go into anything else, except I just remembered the condo language, and it was just a note that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we had the condo craze, right? Now, so there's
right.
Condos are a good thing, and we want to encourage all modes of types of development. We want to just be thoughtful that we're not adding incentives to convert rentals into condo, mm-hmm. and that creates another set of challenges that I think is important to look out for.
Thanks. I'll keep my eyes open on that one.
In closing, you're going to come back as these things get more fleshed out. There'll be other ones that come forward, like transit-oriented development areas, streamlining, that I know about from Courtney's office as of this morning. There'll be other ones.
Well, and as I look through the bills, I'll have more. These are the ones that we've been spending a lot of time thinking about and trying to figure out, you know, how to present. I think I have some sense of direction from you. Appreciate this conversation, and I'll give you specifics about the bills when they're all available.
So on to the climate change?
On to climate, yes. Give me one second to...
Just wait. 2 seconds. Do we need a break? Anybody need a break?
Good.
Fine.
Okay.
I mean, stand up from time to time.
Well, I was, yeah.
So I have spoken to, I think, all of you individually about this, and I want to... Let me kind of give you a very high-level, quick summary. The legislature, there have been bills in the sort of cap and invest category that have been introduced several times over the last few years with increasing levels of attention and effort over time. One was introduced several years ago back, and then it got set aside when the coal to clean legislation kind of took over, became the issue of that session. But
2016.
Something like that, yeah. And then legislators have continued to work pretty hard behind the scenes to develop a proposal. As you may know, there are sort of two main approaches to addressing climate change through basically tax incentive policy. One is a carbon tax, and the other is so-called cap and trade. Carbon tax, you know what you're going to pay, but you don't know how much carbon is going to be reduced. With cap and trade, what the policy does is it sets the amount of carbon that can be emitted. So it guarantees the reductions in emissions, and then the market sets the price for the allowances to emit that amount of carbon. So the policy decision at the legislature has been to pursue the latter, the cap and trade, or as they're calling it, cap and invest, which is, you know, a marketing phrase. Otherwise, also known, the other marketing phrase, clean energy jobs. So the legislature introduced a bill at the end of the 2017 session that was sort of a marker, like a first conversation piece. Between 2017 and 2018, they had a number of work groups that I sat on one of those work groups related to utilities and transportation, which ended up being really all about utilities and very little time on transportation. But they made a pretty good effort to develop that bill during the 2018 session, but leadership asked them to step back and take some more time, and then leadership committed to advance this in 2019, and that commitment was signaled by the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House co-chairing the Joint Carbon Reduction Committee in the interim. Going forward, they will no longer be co-chairing that committee, but most of the members that were on it will remain on it. It continues to be a joint committee, and it's one of, as I think I said on Tuesday, this is one of the four priorities that at least Speaker Kotek mentioned when I heard her speak a month or so ago for the legislature to really move forward on this session. So there are two ways that this potentially affects Metro's interests, one much more important than the other. On the solid waste side, California has exempted waste from their cap and trade program, and there was some speculation that might happen in Oregon, but apparently there is some other way that waste is dealt with in California, and in Oregon I believe waste is going to be part of the program, which means that emissions from the solid waste system, and mainly emissions from landfills, will in fact need to acquire allowances through this auction system, and so there will be basically a price attached to emissions from waste, and that will create an incentive then for waste reduction as those prices increase over time. The main concern, and having had a conversation internally with staff about that, we agreed that's appropriate. If you're going to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions, those are emissions, you know, on which price should be put, because it creates an incentive for doing something. The one kind of outlier notion, it was like, how does this affect our closed landfill, St. John's landfill? And we believe that it wouldn't affect that landfill because the emissions are below the threshold where it would be subject to this requirement. But I did get language put in last session, just in case, exempting closed landfills from having to pay these for allowances if they're operating in compliance with their DEQ permit. So I suspect we won't have to worry about solid waste in this bill at all, but I just want to mention it, and you know, for your benefit. The big question is around transportation, and what I have been doing so far has been to tell every legislator I talk to, remember the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act, where you directed us, thanks to some stellar nonprofit advocacy, where you directed us, legislature, you directed Metro to develop and implement a plan for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation system. We did that. It's called the Climate Smart Strategy. We got it adopted in the region with broad support. It's been approved by the Land Conservation and Development Commission. It is a state-approved plan for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. Now, you are going to be generating money, proceeds, we say, not revenues, from the sale of, from the auction of allowances to emit carbon from transportation fuels. Those dollars that are generated will be considered subject to the constitutional requirement that they be spent in the road right of way. There's a separate legal question about whether that is required or not, but that's politically, that's what's going to happen. The legislature will say these are, we're going to spend these in the road right of way. And so what I've been saying to every legislator that I talk to is, you directed us to develop this plan that is carbon and transportation specific. Now you are going to have money that is carbon and transportation specific. We don't have enough money to implement this plan you told us to do. Help us with these new dollars.
You might remind them that in our report we told them that while we have a strategy, it will not be achievable without significant additional investment from the state.
Right. So, and I've said that again and again. So, in the short session, I did get some language, not beautiful language, but language, anyway, into the bill at that time, saying that the legislature shall seek to invest in the implementation of basically climate smart strategies, I mean, with the statutory reference to what it is, and also to the development of similar plans and the implementation of similar plans in other MPOs. So between then and now, it's, you know, there's been a lot of work done, and a lot of it is sort of behind the curtain. And we don't really know how this bill is going to look. One of the concerns about the bill that happened last year was that the money was going to be distributed by the legislature. So there wasn't a way to create some sort of a formula. Every 2 years, the legislature would come and say, this is how much money we have, and they would decide how to spend it. The bill did require that the money should only be spent in ways that reduce greenhouse gas, or greenhouse gas emissions, that contribute to climate adaptation and that support impacted communities, which may also be, you know, while you're supporting impacted communities, you're also doing the other two things. I expect that those same restrictions, those same, you know, purposes will be carried forward in the new legislation, but the new legislation has not yet emerged. It's not in the stack that came out today, for instance. It was not, the bill was not pre-session filed. So some of the concerns that we have are that there are interests that are seeking to have this money distributed the same way as other transportation money through a formula that makes it seem like it's road money. So
based on maintenance and operation of the roads.
Right, exactly.
That's what that is based on.
Right. It's also based on the fact that roads are owned by the state and cities and counties. Obviously, those other monies should be distributed to the people that own and maintain and operate those roads. But this money is for a different purpose, and so I've been advocating that it not be subject to those sort of formulaic distribution requirements. I guess my what I'm suggesting,
if they did it in a similar way, it would be where the emissions are.
It would be
based on the percentage of where the massive amount of emissions are.
That's where
true,
the should be.
True. It would be more
what this is based on is the use of the road and the mileage. The mileage in a jurisdiction and how much it's used, right? Those are the two basics.
50-30-20.
Yeah. If you apply that same idea, it's how much greenhouse gas emissions are generated and how much is it going to take to bring it back down. That's how it, I mean, there was a formula.
But bringing it back down isn't necessarily invest. You know, those investments are not the same as the kinds of investments.
No, but the point being, use the same idea, concept with them. Got it. Let's do a percentage. Right. Where a percentage should be coming also to the region.
Right. And we've argued that 70% of the greenhouse gas emissions approximately are coming from the 8 MPOs. And
the what?
The 8 MPOs.
8 MPOs.
So there should be something that recognizes that. Obviously, the way the money might be spent might be different in urban areas than in rural areas. Yeah. Maybe more money in rural areas would be spent on adaptation than on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But at any rate, this is an open conversation right now. And I've been having conversations, you know, Margie and I have been having a number of conversations with some of our partners, both local government partners as well as nonprofit advocacy partners. I'd say the general sense among the people that we've been talking to has been, A, support the legislation. We do want to have legislation to address climate change. B, it's critical that money be directed from the proceeds, the transportation-related proceeds, to the implementation of the climate smart strategy and the development, and, you know, secondarily, I guess, from Metro's perspective, the development and implementation of similar strategies in other areas. I'll probably stay silent on that in Salem because it's not my, you know, I stick to my knitting a little bit. Stay in my lane, I think, is what they say. I think, you know, we've made that point to the other people that are working on this. And then third, the money be spent in a way that is the most, it has the highest return on investment, you know, basically the highest greenhouse gas reduction benefit per dollar spent. Or that be at least the North Star, if I may, President Peterson, for the primary principle behind how the money is spent. There is a fourth potential priority. Fourth potential priority, or you know, a policy recommendation, I think, would be that there be a distribution mechanism that is regional in nature. I mean, obviously, that's the opposite of the 50-30-20 approach. A distribution mechanism that would be regional in nature, where we could most strategically deploy those dollars to implement the plan that we already have. I feel like, you know, if we get the first three things, it'll probably flow naturally to that. But at any rate, that's the direction that I've been pursuing. And I'm going to have to report back to you once we start hearing what does the bill look like, what is the actual structure within which we want to advance these concepts, because it's a little bit of a black box, I'd say, right now. Would you say still about what the bill is going to look like and how it's actually going to advance the policy?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is talk about the threat of referral and how that's playing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
The black box of this.
Yeah. So, some of the interests that end up when we had a transportation package passed in 2017. There was a big negotiation with essentially the truckers in AAA, who are sort of the ones that provide a political check on how high the gas taxes can be increased. And so there's a concern, I think, among some of those types of entities, as well as some of the rural legislators, that because this is going to require, this is going to basically increase gas prices again, that you're doubling up on what you just did with the transportation package. And the concern that is that if this gets referred, it's going to have trouble passing on the ballot. So I don't know what else to say beyond that, except that that's there, that the legislature is very aware of it. I moderated a panel on this at the Oregon Transportation Forum a couple months ago, and, you know, with legislators, and asked that question, and they said, well, let's just say we've got to write something that doesn't get referred. So it's going to be a highly negotiated deal at the end of the day, and you know what that means remains to be seen.
So do we want to do round robin? I don't know if anybody's not going to want to talk about this.
Just go around the table.
Yeah,
one time.
Christine.
I am broadly supportive and have been following along for at least the past 6 years. So my hope is that conversations are more graceful than they have been in the past about serious commitment to getting something passed. And in terms of funding Climate Smart, I think making sure that all areas of the region that want to partake can, even if they're a little bit behind some of our smarter cities. And then also just making sure that we have an understanding with, say, the non-metro area of Clackamas County that may serve to benefit by riding some of our coattails if we are going to be receiving local funds. But I think the general framework and your involvement to make sure that we are able to implement some of the policy that has been ready to go for a while is really critical.
Could I quickly actually respond to the comment about I had a conversation, as I think I might have told you, I'm not sure, with the Clackamas County lobbyist a week or two ago. And it was a good conversation where he noted, well, does this mean all the money gets spent where all the traffic is, et cetera? You know, and it's a conversation that, as you know, President Peterson has been a long, ongoing conversation with Clackamas County over lots of different kinds of funding streams. And so it does raise a question for, I think, maybe future council discussion when we see the bill about whether there needs to be a conversation similar to the one that we had when we thought there might be a regional increment in the transportation package about how money might be distributed within the region. 50-30-20, we don't think is the right idea, but to your point, Councillor, I think that's something that we should discuss at the appropriate time.
Thank you.
I think it's probably too soon just because I don't know what this bill looks like yet, and we have more regional conversations to have. Okay, thanks. Sorry.
Go this way?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm very supportive of the concept behind the legislation. I presume that revenue from the sale of these allowances generated by petroleum products will be subject to the Highway Trust Fund to the extent that those petroleum products are used to propel automobiles and trucks. I presume, although there may be arguments to the contrary that make sense, that those portions of the allowance revenue that are derived from transportation will have to be spent largely in the right-of-way, not for light rail lines, not for station development outside of the right-of-way, but right-of-way improvements include, you know, streets, traffic signals, sidewalks. That means our objectives about pedestrian safety that make it more likely that we walk more, bike more, ride transit more as a means of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector can be realized to a greater extent because we make our streets, our boulevards, our highways safer for all users. And bus priority treatments are a category of such in the right-of-way improvements.
Yep.
Like bike lanes, they're stripes of paint, they're traffic signal heads, they're relocating bus stops to the far side of an intersection with a light to allow bus priority in an existing lane. If we want to add a lane and exclusively devote that lane to busway, that might be a problem. If we're striping differently, if we're accelerating bus traffic in existing rights of way, if we're creating safer streets for people, all those things can aid our achievement of our greenhouse gas reduction goals consistently with the Highway Trust Fund and consistently with taking the revenues from petroleum and spending them subject to the Highway Trust Fund. I offer this supposition that a city that presumes particularly in this metro area, that presumes that the allocation of 20% of all revenues to cities is a better guarantee, I think Beaverton or Hillsborough is going to have the opportunity to get more than 20%. The 20% share of the total state that's allocated to cities, and then their proportional share of that, they're going to be able to get more out of a deal that emphasizes improvements in the right-of-way that facilitate pedestrian, bicycle safety, and access to transit than they would from a flat 20%. And doing the numbers on that would aid us in building a coalition that's a little stronger and more robust in the metropolitan area. I can't do that math, but I think somebody ought to do it.
So I'll mention one more thing. I'm going to jump in when I have something that responds directly, if it's okay. Margie and Kim and Michelle Belia primarily have put together a chart of what we think is allowed, what kinds of investments that can advance climate smart that are allowed, that may be allowed, and that are not allowed under the constitutional restrictions. And if we think that's almost ready for prime time,
that's
I think
ready.
Yeah. So we'll send that around to you. And certainly for comment, if you have other thoughts, we'll be open to them. But that's as of the last couple of days, I think that's pretty much ready to share.
So, thanks.
Okay. Did you jot that down?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I was going to just ask the question, but Bob probably answered it for me already. Is there any way that there might be a chance that this doesn't happen, we don't have to follow the Constitution to distribute
this? The Constitution could be interpreted differently.
Yeah. Has anybody started looking at that, or our attorneys?
Yes.
Like, look at all those nodding heads over there.
There have been a lot of attorneys looking at that at the state level, and I think there is some ambiguity because of the sort of arcane nature of this mechanism. I think they have decided politically they're not going to go there. However, there are other. So the transportation part of the wedge is, you know, a significant chunk, but there are a few other chunks of the pie, you know, including chunks that are not restricted, and that from which proceeds could be used for instance, transit investments that are not on the road right-of-way.
Off right-of-way bicycle improvements.
Off, you know, trails, as well as things like transit-oriented affordable housing, which has been shown to be another greenhouse gas reduction strategy. So some of those things were actually mentioned in the bill last year. I assume they'll be mentioned this year, but they can't be bought with this restricted money. There's other money in the bill that might be available for those purposes.
Thank you.
And that you add those two together, and you can really implement climate smart.
Well, I already was able to weigh in on this in our last earlier session, so appreciate that. I would be interested in the chart also.
You would too.
And seeing that.
We'll send it around.
Everybody, yeah.
Maybe to everybody. But we'll just keep going around here.
The charts, yeah.
Well, the chart on the what that funding
the Marty's going to give us.
What can we do to implement climate
right.
smart?
Right. We'll get that out at the end of the day.
I think this is probably one of the most important issues that we'll tackle in the 21st century. I've said that many a times. And I think we need to do whatever we can to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and the next generation is counting on us. I know that's more of a moral argument.
You're counting on us to vote with you.
Yeah. And I'm very, very supportive of this legislation.
I'm reminded, from what you just said, I'm reminded of something that Willie Nelson recently just said, is when we look at climate regulation and whatnot, that millennials and the generations to come need to think about what kind of a world they're going to leave Willie and Keith Richards.
Because, of course, they'll still be around.
Most of you have devoted most of your comments to, like, how can we spend the money? How should the money be spent? I'd like to go back and talk about just the concept behind cap and invest at all. In general, I tend to be inclined toward not more regulation, but less instead. But in this case, this is an issue where it's kind of an extension of the existing Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, where we said you can't just dump your waste into the streams and rivers. You can't just puke any amount of dirt you want into the sky. And this is addressing it from a different direction, and if I may say so, it's a much more capitalistic way to look at it. Rather than just limiting it, you cannot do this. You say, we'll come up with a reasonable amount that's allowed, and then you can buy it. And in return for your investment, you get to do this, but in return, we get money to mitigate the issues, and we make sure that those levels are limited below what is negatively impactful on human existence. So to me, this is a better way to do it than just having automatic restrictions on things. And for that reason, I think it's a great way to deal with the issue, and it is an issue that needs to be dealt with. I've said in the past where I tend to be a little bit skeptical about human-caused climate change. That doesn't mean I don't think we need clean air and clean water, and we need to leave. I think we, as a generation, are duty-bound to leave the world cleaner than we got it. And so this is a way to achieve that. So I'm in favor of that. When it comes to the issue of what are the limitations on how we can spend it, as it's been, I'm interested to see what the chart shows, but what I've heard from people in general is, even with the constitutional restriction, there's a lot we can do with it to move forward with things in general and specific things that we've identified in the Climate Smart Strategy that we want to be able to achieve, having to do with improved transit times, timing of lights, better improved bus pullouts that get them out of the right-of-way so traffic can continue to flow. There's all kinds of great things that can be done with the money, even with the restriction. So even if that constitutional restriction is in place, I don't think that should keep us from being supportive of the measure as a whole.
Cool. We've all worked around.
So the only thing I was going to add is so much without an understanding of exactly what's in the Climate Smart Strategies, there, I'm assuming, is a list of things that we can pull out, or you already have, that has numbers associated with it, so we know what the cost of this plan in general would be, because I think we should be prepared for the earmarking of this money happening. And if we don't have our programs at least prioritized and the actual amount set next to it. One, we don't know how much we actually need when you go down there and you say 50, 30, 20 doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Two, when the earmarking begins, we will be left out in the cold. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to be prepared from that standpoint.
Good point. Yeah.
That's my only input. Okay.
Do you want me to speak to that?
Do you have something to say to it? Sure.
I think it's just it's not clean math. It never is. But what we do have is projects in the RTP that we just adopted. We have over 1,000 projects in the RTP. Some are maybe not described as much in specific as we want, but what we can do is kind of get a general sense and say to the transit priority, we can say we've got X amount of need in our RTP that we just adopted that needs funding. We have this many bike ped projects in the right of way approximately that need funding. So that's how I'd approach it. It doesn't, EVs, things like that are not within the highway trust fund. Those are harder to calculate anyway, but in this case, I don't think we need to. So that's how
we do know what TriMet would need for accelerating and pushing for an electric bus purchasing.
So those are would be without
outside the revenue.
So the revenue sources, the same earmarking argument.
No, I think the point is a good one, and I think we should do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm not saying we need a set number of projects within the programs, but if there are programs specified and we have some sort of general direction, and we know it would be about $20 million to get all of the projects in the RTP, put it at 25 or 30, right? I mean,
right.
Let's just put a number to it and say why.
We have a list.
Kim and I played around with these numbers already a little bit. Yeah. So we'll now that we have your direction to do so, we'll.
Right.
We normally don't earmark in Oregon. We try and stay away from that. I get that, but I have I'd like to be
somebody
prepared.
Will try it.
Well,
somebody will try.
I'm interested to see whether they do the same thing they did before, which is have the legislature distribute this money every 2 years. They may do something different, and it's like I say, it's been a black box. I will say, in terms of the order of magnitude, the original estimate a year ago, more than a year ago, was about $240 million a year, and the numbers have gone up since then. I've heard numbers up as high as $400 million a year. I'm not sure where it's really going to land, but it's a chunk of money. And so if you look at what our region's sort of proportional share of that would be, it's a significant amount of potential investment. So I think I have what I need from you right now. We'll get that chart to you hopefully by the end of the day or tomorrow.
Chris, can I say something very shortly, very quickly? I just want everybody to know that Randy and I have had a few conversations, one in my initial briefing and a couple like hallway conversations. It's not rising to the level of needing to be part of our legislative agenda. I think it's important that we stay nimble and flexible in light of our platform of wanting to enact policy to become an employer of choice, and how we respond to employer mandates, employer requirements, and even such things as child care, paid family leave, as they're discussed in the legislature, and just keep our ears open and be ready to have those discussions in the future.
Good point.
I don't need an answer, but so the 50, 30, 20,
Yeah.
So right now, that if they want to use that process, that then automatically sends the money to ODOT, to the cities, to the counties. So how will we see that money comes this direction and then it's redistributed?
That's why Randy's trying to
find
a different way.
Yeah, that's why we don't think it should go that way.
Okay, right. Lynn is suggesting, this is the kind of in the backdoor system that the money would be regionally distributed or come to Metro and then be regionally distributed.
The hard part is I haven't come up with like a specific proposal like about how that should be done yet, and I think, you know, that I think we need
to answer that. To me, the easiest point of saying it's a regional... it's a regional plan, but it's a regional implementation actions that need to be taken, is because it's a non-point source problem, and it doesn't have a boundary.
Right.
So even if you've given 30% to the cities, that means the region gets something tiny and the little gets something tiny, but we actually haven't made a dent in the actual problem. Where's the actual problem? Right? That's just based on the operations and maintenance of an existing infrastructure system, which is valid and we need to keep it, but it doesn't apply here.
You'll recall, well, those of you that were on JPACT anyway will recall a couple of years ago, I don't remember the exact proposal, but it was a proposal that Andy Cotugno had put together around transportation, like creating a more of a regional transportation fund out of a package that didn't actually even get passed that year, but it was going into the 2015 session, I think. And we brought a proposal forward. Remember that?
No, I got it. I have another idea.
Oh, okay. We brought that proposal forward to JPAC, and it was basically an alternative to 50-30-20, and it was shot down by JPAC. And the larger jurisdictions generally voted against it because they were going to get significant amounts of money, and the smaller jurisdictions that were going to get small amounts of money thought, oh, wouldn't it be better if we pooled this regionally, and they voted for it, but the votes didn't pan out. So we need to think about the politics of that and how that works when we have this conversation.
There is a way to take the idea of the regional air quality conversation with this and marry the two together so you have a monitoring and implementation. That would be
sort of the way we do with federal dollars,
come
you mean?
Here. There was talk about having
the regional air quality authority, yeah.
But it could actually be housed here in Metro, and we could get direction to do that, and then the money would flow through that.
Well, actually, I think you were on the right track earlier, which is that we have a climate smart strategy that lays out certain strategies. The RTP identifies specific projects that would implement that strategy, and so it seems like the reason for it to come here isn't air quality, it's that we have a strategy to address this very thing. You're saying you would be an air quality authority, I think.
But it would really be actually major change. We are major air quality.
I just don't assure you necessarily want to tie those two issues to you. You're saying you do.
No, I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, I guess I have two comments on this, and you know, Randy and I have talked about what would we do if we got the proceeds. And well, first of all, I can easily see the work plan. I mean, I think this is one of our best talking points, is that we have a longstanding history of delivering good grant programs that are transparent for this purpose. We've got the TISMO program with the Transport Committee. We've got the RTO program. We just launched a Safe Roads to School program. We have RFFA. We know how to do this. And we would basically take our existing programs and our emerging technology program and beef them up and add and just flow money, but we probably are best positioned than anyone in the state to get climate transportation money out the door. So I think that's a selling point. The other piece that I just wanted to respond to on the 50-30-20 is after HB 2017 passed, the MTIP staff, we surveyed all the jurisdictions that received that money to find out what exactly they're doing with them. All of our jurisdictions, 27, only two were using them for capital improvements. The other ones were all 20. Using it, 25, were all using it for maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that tells you where the money goes, and that's because they have a maintenance need, but they do not use it for capital funding to make it, you know, to change the system. So that's just another talking point that I'd like to add.
Yeah.
I mean,
I should remember. I've heard it before, and I should remember what I'm talking to legislators.
I'll write a bullet for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. That, anything else that you need?
I am good. I will take your input and actually, I don't think I have to change any of the documents now, except for the edit that we made earlier, to put together the package for you to actually adopt your legislative agenda, which, as you know, you adopt at a pretty high level. And then these conversations, though, are very helpful to me carrying forward your policy agenda in Salem. So thank you for the good discussion. And
thank you for all the work.
Thank you. And thanks to my team out here that's been helpful on a lot of these issues as well.
I closed up my thing.
You close up your thing.
It's only council communications left.
We already did that.
We already did. Yep. Check.
Brian doesn't need to communicate.
All right, then we're done. Thank you.
If anybody would like to see a good example of a cottage cluster, if you don't know what that is, we talked about it earlier. There's a very good example in Tigard.